Hi there, Wendy Carlisle with the latest episode from Background Briefing. 5 years ago, a hospital in the Northern Territory was facing closure. Its doctors were out of their depth, and the Indigenous patients that it was meant to serve were walking out of the wards in droves. What's happened in that time period of 5 years is a remarkable story of how this hospital has turned its fortunes around, and it now ranks amongst Australia's best for its relationship with its Indigenous patients. It's a good news story. So how did Katherine Hospital in the Northern Territory do it, and what lessons does this have for the rest of the nation? Hagar Cohen has this report.
It's only 30 kilometres from Katherine. It's called Binjari.
It's late afternoon and we're in the car with Dr. Simon Quilty. He's the head physician in town at the Katherine Hospital. We've just arrived at Binjari, an Aboriginal community of about 300 people, which is 30 kilometres from Katherine.
And Binjari community is made up of people who are all from the west side of town, so Narrinbin people, Waterman people, to a lesser extent, Gurindji people. And this was, I guess, their refuge that was set up, I don't know how long ago, and I don't really know the history of it. But there's a lot of poverty, there's a lot of extreme overcrowding of houses.
Like so many people who have come to live in the Northern Territory, Simon is originally from down south.
I have nightmares about eating, being eaten by a crocodile. If I could choose how to die, there'd be one thing. It would be that it's not via the mouth of a crocodile. I mean, the jaws of a bloody dinosaur tearing you to pieces.
Simon was born, bred and trained as a medical doctor in Sydney. He moved here to Katherine 5 years ago to turn the hospital's fortunes around.
Hey, mate. Hey, fella. Can I ask you, you know that June Williams, you know where she lives? June Williams? Yeah, you know that old lady June? Do you know which house he lives in? Nah, that's all right. Okay, what's your name? Malachi, my name's Simon. Nice to meet you. What's your last name? James, Malachi James.
Malachi is kicking a football with a bunch of other kids and he looks apprehensive. He's uncomfortable with Simon's questions.
I'm not from the government, eh? Just got a flash car.
Simon couldn't find the old lady he came to see. He knows her from Katherine Hospital, where she's a patient of his. 80% of his patients are Aboriginal. They come into the hospital from a gigantic desert catchment, about twice the size of Victoria. Many of the people here live traditional lives. 2 centuries after Captain Cook, dispossession has not been kind.
More and more younger people are developing type 2 diabetes, like 15, 14, 13-year-olds are developing type 2 diabetes, and then they've got kidney impairment by the time they're 25 or 26, and they're on dialysis in their early, mid-30s, and it's just poverty. A bit terrifying, really, because going to a funeral for a small Aboriginal child is normal. Katherine region has the highest rates of homelessness and the highest mortality rate of any region in Australia.
Hi, I'm Hagar Cohen. On Background Briefing, the incredible story of the transformation of Katherine Hospital. From having one of the worst records in dealing with Aboriginal people to the best. People in the Katherine region get really sick at a very young age, so the hospital is important. But before Simon arrived in 2011, it was letting its Indigenous patients down badly. The hospital was understaffed and many of the doctors were hopelessly out of their depth. It was so dysfunctional, it was on the verge of shutting down. But then, a new general manager and a bunch of new doctors, all of them white, arrived with an ambition to turn things around. What has happened over the last 5 years has been a quiet revolution and a model for how Indigenous healthcare might be delivered across the nation. This story is about why this happened and how. It's just another day in the emergency department, and a Jawin elder, an old lady, has been rushed in. She's got acute kidney failure and her life is in danger.
She's pretty sick. I have said, look, if you're not looking, if you're not passing the urine, like, you could finish up.
If she doesn't get treatment, she could die. That's what Dr. Richard Budd means when he says she could finish up. Her doctors want to send her north to Darwin Hospital for dialysis, 300 kilometres away.
She knows that she's very unwell. She's made it pretty clear that she doesn't want to go to Darwin. And so I don't want her to distress her, because I think her fear is that we might send her to Darwin against her will. But if this illness doesn't reverse immediately, then she'll probably be lucky to make the weekend.
She knows that going to Darwin might save her life, but Darwin Hospital is too far from her country and family, so the doctors are about to negotiate with her. It will be complex and require great knowledge and understanding about her culture and wishes.
But in a couple of hours, if she's not responding to therapy, then we'll have to have a conversation, and it'll be good to have that with all of the family. So the ED staff will be in the process of getting family in to have a family discussion. She needs a big boss doctor to have that conversation with her and her family, and the family will know who the boss doctors are, and they'll expect to have the boss doctor talk to them about it.
These conversations are now routine, but not so long ago, they weren't. The doctors didn't have the skills or the resources, and this old woman would have had no say in her treatment. Dr. Simon Quilty.
She would have been sent to Darwin.
Against her will?
It wouldn't have even been considered, and when people are that sick, that nuance isn't even really discussed. Particularly when you've got a junior doctor who's out of their depth, they call for care flight, care flight arrives, and the patient is shipped to Darwin.
In 2011, one in four Indigenous patients would walk out of the hospital before they were well enough, because they didn't feel the hospital cared for them and they didn't trust the doctors.
And that was a particular downtime. The roots of it was junior staff that didn't have enough support. What was happening is that everybody that was even mildly unwell was flown out. People probably weren't satisfied with their care. People were recognising that maybe they were wasting their time with the hospital a bit.
Because the hospital couldn't help them.
Yeah, possibly. I think one of the other things is that when people were admitted to the ward prior to my arrival, they were treated by very infrequent junior staff. And even day to day, they'd be seen by a different doctor almost every day or two. So there was no continuity of care. And because it was a very challenging job for the juniors, they would turn over very rapidly. The hospital was, and still is, reliant on locum staff, and locum staff aren't invested in the community.
In fact, the situation was so out of control, Dr. Quilty says it wasn't safe.
These people have very complex illnesses that for many of them are highly, highly likely, if not treated well, to result in significant injury or death. And hospitals like this in remote locations, even though they service small populations, they really need a higher degree of expertise to deal with the very sick patients that turn up here. And what had happened at 2010, I think the hospital just found itself in a position where things are really falling apart.
The Territory government couldn't ignore the disaster unfolding in Katherine and ordered an investigation. Its report remains confidential, but two of the findings left no doubt about what was likely to happen if action was not taken. One finding noted
significant deficiencies in nearly all the essential dimensions of safe clinical service provision.
The language was bureaucratic, but the meaning was crystal clear. The way the hospital was operating was broken, and it would only get worse.
Root cause is that the medical service model is unsustainable and becomes more unsustainable with each passing year.
Angela Branerly was hired as general manager shortly after this investigation was completed. She's part of the visionary team in the hospital who has turned the hospital's culture on its head.
We took it very seriously and made some really serious changes to the way that the medical team are supported here. It is around ensuring that they know someone's got their back, that you can't just take an experienced medical officer or an experienced senior nurse and put them in a small hospital and then go, off you go and do it, you'll be right, without ensuring they've got appropriate support in place to allow them to do the job.
At that time, over one in four Indigenous patients took off from the hospital before they were well. In hospital speak, they took their own leave. The reasons are complex, but the gist of it is that they didn't believe their treatment was adequate. Now things have vastly improved. Instead of 25% of patients taking off, less than 5% are doing it. Katherine Hospital's Aboriginal Liaison Officer is Teresa Heidel.
I actually see them when I'm driving into work. You know, I know they've taken off from the hospital because they're walking flat out, straight ahead, or they still might have the nightie on. Yeah, they're tricky.
The term take own leave is measured by all hospitals. It's recognised by health departments as a KPI, a measurement for the quality of Aboriginal healthcare. In 2011, Katherine Hospital's rates were the worst in the nation. But now they're one of the best. It's a remarkable success story, and it means that patients are staying in hospital, receiving therapy and getting better. Teresa says getting people to remain in hospital has been a lot of hard work.
That's a hard one. I think they go on the moment. I'm feeling good, so I must be all right. That's how it goes.
And you try and explain that that doesn't...
Yeah, I do explain how long they'll probably need to be taking that medication, you know. Or if that's your medication, if you stop taking that, you'll be finished soon. Yeah. And they, yeah, a lot of them, they don't have that big understanding for medications, doctor's words. They don't. We've got to break it down as simple as we can. And if we can't break it down simple, we have to get an interpreter to come in and break it down. And it's like the word cancer. There's not an Aboriginal word that means cancer. So how do you explain those things to them? Yeah, sometimes it's better getting an interpreter and they'll think of ways around it. Yeah. Yeah, I remember one day a lady had this fungus and there's no word for those things on women's bodies or inside. So I heard the interpreter tell her, you know, like mushrooms growing? They've got her to stay, but, yeah, to get treated.
One of the new changes has been the introduction of weekly meetings to go over care plans for the Indigenous patients. That never used to happen. It's an opportunity for everyone in the hospital to keep up with what's happening with individual patients. One of their patients is a man with heart disease and diabetes from Nooka, which is 330 kilometres southeast of Katherine. This is Dr. Pip Tallis.
32-year-old Indigenous man from Nooka. He's come in with a febrile illness. It's probably a bit of a flu or pneumonia, but he's also had significant fluid overload and he's got severe mitral stenosis from rheumatic heart disease. The other issue is that he's morbidly obese, 108 kilos, and no one will operate on him at this stage until he loses weight.
Another patient has been admitted with a serious burn on the back of her hand. The doctors, Simon, Pip and Richard, are concerned that if she takes off, as she'd been threatening to do, her hand will get infected.
So I guess this time we addressed that alcohol was probably something that might be contributing to why she wanted to leave the hospital. So we use a medication to just take away the edge a little bit so that she's not withdrawing from alcohol, and it makes her a little bit more calm and so less desperate to get out of the hospital. So at least we can treat this burn injury for her and ensure that her encephalopathy is better.
Anyway, looks like she's staying here today. Yeah. Unless she can sleep. Work out
she's
how.
She's a bit
sleepy. I don't think she'll be able to work out how to get out of the bed.
No.
Well, you never know. Yeah. She's a tough lady.
None of the doctors here are Aboriginal, and sometimes it's really hard to breach the gap between white and black culture. It comes across in every aspect of the treatment plan, including the definition of what is an illness and how to deal with it.
I think they aren't understanding how serious the disease is.
Yeah.
So Simon's got a really good way of explaining it that I've started using as well.
So Aboriginal people, have you ever seen Bush Mechanics?
Yeah.
Aboriginal people are very mechanistic and very clever at understanding problems when they can put it together in their heads. And so I've actually started using it in non-Aboriginal people too, because it's quite a good explanation, but I describe it as sticky, sweet blood. So I say, you know, I show them my veins, like I've got these big blue veins, and I can show them the blood flows through, and then I say, the problem with your diabetes is too much sugar in the blood, and then I compare it to water, and if you put a bit of cordial in it, it gets a bit sticky, and then if you've just got the cordial soup, it's very sticky. The more sugar you have in it, the stickier it gets, and that makes complete sense to them. And then you say, so what do you think would happen in these pipes if it's got sticky blood flowing through it? Slowly you won't feel it, and then it'll block up, and then it causes problems with your feet and your heart and your stroke, and you can't feel your hands. And then I talk to them about how the medications we use pulls the sugar out of the blood. And I think, I don't know, I think I repeat that story regularly.
I think most white people would kind of say, oh, yes, diabetes, I know that's bad, and I need to do something, and it'll make, and even though they might not take that many medications or still eat badly, they know it's bad. But to then say to an indigenous person, oh, I reckon you've got diabetes, and I'm like, oh, I don't think I do. Or, don't really believe in it. Yeah. Oh, I'm a bit stuck now. You don't believe in it. What do you mean you don't believe in it? Oh, right, okay. It's like Santa.
But it is just exploring that next level of nuance for their understanding.
Because
they're so polite, they'll just say, yes, I do have diabetes. And then when you say, do you really understand? Then you start unpeeling the fact that they don't even think they've got diabetes, and they're just trying to be polite to you and wait for you to leave and then get on with their lives.
Yeah.
I think in the meantime, we try to be relatively respectful in terms of bush medicine and, you know, black magic and witch doctors and things, and encourage it. If they'd like to have that as part of their treatment, then certainly facilitate it. And we've had, you know, a witch doctor come into the hospital once before for a type 1 diabetic with abdominal pain, and they removed the bone that was causing them abdominal pain, and they were feeling much better. And so I think, especially things like, often it's the ladies with like itch or something like that, and they want to put the bush medicine cream on them. Like, I'm always happy for them to do whatever, and sort of incorporate that in our treatment plan as well. So this is what we'll do with white man medicine, but we'll also add, you know, we can do bush medicine as well for you if you bring it in. The only trouble is that they say there's no bush medicine around Catherine, that you have to go out bush to get it. So we've been stuck.
Keeping patients who don't believe in white fella medicine is tricky. A patient here, 30-year-old Jason, has tuberculosis. It's a communicable disease, and under law, he must stay at the hospital until he stops being infectious. He's got a pretty bad case of TB, and it's taking a long, long time to clear. It's been frustrating. His treating doctor is physician Richard Budd.
So Jason's got tuberculosis, so it's obviously an infectious disease, and so there's very strict rules about risk of spread to other people. So he needs to have treatment and engage with treatment so that he's no longer infectious.
Jason is already taken off from the hospital once. Dr. Richard says it's because he never truly believed his treatment and the medication was helping.
First of all, convincing somebody that these tablets that potentially initially might make you feel more unwell is the right treatment, and to have them doing it for 6 months is challenging. So once again, it's a matter of engaging with them, making sure that they trust you, and then also having a degree of flexibility. So, I mean, he wanted to go to his father's grave, but then in actual fact, he disappeared for a day, which isn't acceptable. And that becomes like a public health problem.
So how is he feeling about
the hospital? He's not happy, he wants to get out, yeah.
Like many of the Indigenous patients here, Jason doesn't like the hospital's air conditioning. He much prefers to sit outside on the veranda.
So being in a cold clinical environment is quite like an alien thing for a lot of Indigenous people and can be quite frightening.
So they're here out in the veranda of the hospital?
So we're outside in the veranda of the hospital, and there's a view over the gardens as well. And sitting outside in this environment, it's a lot more of a safe environment for them, and I guess they feel a lot more comfortable sort of interacting in that setting as well.
So usually when you'd be looking for an Indigenous patient, if they're not in their room...
They'll be out here. Yeah. So they'll be out sitting outside.
Which is where we go to find Jason and talk with him. He reveals that part of why he's keen to leave is because he's worried he'll lose his job and lose his home. As the only breadwinner in the family, this situation is making him extremely anxious.
I want to get out, go back to work, because I got my own house. I have to pay rent and that. And if I'm not working, then take my house.
So you worried that you'll lose your place?
Yeah.
Because you can't pay for the rent?
Yeah. Because I'm the only one paying rent from my own house. Yeah.
How many people in your house?
I got a big mob. Yeah, family.
A lot of people that you need to take care of, isn't it? Yeah.
I just want to go home.
Do you want to get better first before you go home, or would you prefer to just go now?
Badly want to go. Go back for bush food and bush medicine.
You want to go back to bush medicine?
Yeah.
What do you think about white people medicine?
Too slow. Yeah. Bush medicine were better, fast, secure. Because I learned from old people of bush medicine. And I know which bush medicine to grab.
You think it works better?
Yeah.
Have they been bringing you some here? Have you been having some bush medicine whilst you've been here?
No.
Nah.
Jason's been in hospital for some time now, and he seems to be settled. But when he did take off to his dad's grave and didn't come back, it fell to his family to convince him to come back.
So how did you manage to get to him to understand or to, like, to cooperate, I guess? Because he was very adamant that bush medicine works a lot
better.
And
I think he'll probably go home and take some bush medicine. We phoned a lot of his family members.
And then his family got him to come.
Yeah, so his mother and his wife was with him, but eventually they convinced him.
Richard's colleague, Dr. Peep Tallis, is doing her training here as a specialist physician. Before coming to Katherine, she worked in Darwin and Alice Springs hospitals. She says it's only since coming to Katherine that she started to understand why so many Indigenous people were walking out of the hospitals.
Previously, I was very inflexible and didn't take the time to appreciate what the issues were for patients who took their own leave. Now I spend a lot more time appreciating it, and I'm also picking up, you can get some very subtle signs on a patient that's starting to not engage, and you instantly know from the end of the bed, I think this is someone that's at risk of take-home leave. So you'll go back at the end of the ward round, sit down, explore their issues, and if they say they want to just go for a walk, you just say, would you like to take some medicines with you just in case you don't come back?
Things have come a long way in Katherine Hospital. It's not only up to the Aboriginal liaison officer to do the cultural work, it's every single staff member here, including, and importantly, the nurses. At the nurses' station, I came across Dr. Simon Quilty and nurse Lee Jo John talking about how much the place has changed.
We used to have so many patients coming here and, you know, has to be transferred to Darwin. But people who live in local, they can have their treatment done in Katherine, you know, most of the time, as long as it's not complicated. But before that wasn't the way, because there wasn't any senior people to look after them as well.
You know what I think? Yeah. I think that when I arrived here, you know how they used to have one junior for that side of the ward and one junior for that side,
Then
they cross over. And I think patients realise realised that they were dealing with very junior doctors. And I think
exactly,
the junior doctors were often
terrified. See, that's the main problem anyway.
Lee Jo remembers how they'd sometimes have to call the police to bring back patients with infectious diseases because they'd walked out of the hospital.
And then it's risk to the community, you know, for example, if they had tuberculosis and scabies and all that.
You had patients with scabies who took their own leave?
We used to have that cases, yeah, and then we have to inform the police and the police will bring them back.
No story illustrates the problems at Katherine Hospital more than what happened to Aboriginal lawman Peter Limbunya. It was August 2006 when the 78-year-old man was admitted to Katherine Hospital. He was very sick and spoke no English.
My uncle was one of those stockmen that had worked for Lord Vestey's on many of the stations around the Victoria River Downs area. His labour was slave labour by Aboriginal people.
This is Josie Croshaw. Peter Limbunya was her uncle, and he, alongside Vincent Lingiari, led the legendary Wave Hill walk-off.
As a result of this hardship by many of the stockmen, they collectively got together, headed up by Dexter Daniels and Vincent Lingiari, and they met at the different campsites and said that this treatment had to stop, this level of slavery and brutality.
But his treatment at Katherine Hospital, which ended in his death, deeply shattered the family and his community at Kalkarindji.
He presented with chronic pneumonia. He was very, very ill. And with his lack of English and his ability to communicate, it was found throughout the coronial inquest at no stage was the interpreter service called upon to actually explain any procedure or what was happening to him, what his condition was, when he could expect to go home.
So he would have known nothing about what was going on?
He would have known absolutely zilch.
The doctors stabilised the old man at Katherine Hospital and he was discharged. He was flown home to Kalkarindji, nearly 500 kilometres away, and the plane landed on the airstrip 5 kilometres from the community. His family weren't told he would be coming home that day, so there was nobody there to meet him.
When they landed, the pilot left the engine of the plane running and he told the old man that he needed to get off. And Uncle, with the help of this man, got down the stairs and was escorted to the gate and the fence line that surrounded the airstrip. And just outside there was a tin shelter. And he left Uncle there and then, you know, he realised that he didn't have his little plastic bag of his clothing. And so the pilot ran back and got that and handed it to Uncle, and without any more words, he flew off into the sky.
The old man tried to walk to his community but couldn't. A whole week passed before three members of his community of Kalkarindji finally found him. It was too late. The Northern Territory Department of Health agreed it was a system breakdown. Josie Croshaw says that what happened is evidence of institutionalised racism.
Words can hardly describe the anger and the deep sadness that our family felt, and the powerlessness, a real sense of powerlessness of how Aboriginal people's lives don't matter.
The coroner recommended a raft of reforms, including Aboriginal cultural awareness training for all staff who work in health across the Northern Territory. But it seems the changes that were brought in did nothing in Katherine. And it was only after the crisis of 2010, when the hospital almost closed down, that real change occurred. One of the people responsible for Katherine Hospital's transformation is the Director of Medical Services, who came to the hospital 5 years ago.
Dr. Louise Harwood is giving us a tour of the facilities. One of the first things she noticed was the maternity ward. She reckons it's the best in the country.
This is the maternity ward. So we have about 300 births a year. And I think we have the best maternity ward in Australia. So all the rooms are like this. There's a single room with an ensuite, and they open out onto the veranda here.
Wow, with a veranda.
So, yeah, so this is the Catherine Resort maternity unit.
The private rooms are well used and loved by everyone. But as for the birthing bath, it looks a bit out of place. Oh my goodness, look at this bath.
Yeah, so if you want to have a water birth, there's facilities here. I don't think people choose it very often, to be honest, but it's here.
So why was it put in place if people don't like it here?
I think, well, I don't know that they don't like it, but I think there was a sense that it's an option that some people like to have, and that if you're going to do that, you want to do it properly.
Is there a story behind the bath?
There's probably some midwives who thought, this is what I would like.
So is it common in Aboriginal culture?
No.
So they don't use it?
No. There's been one baby born in that bath, and that was an accidental. I shouldn't say that.
Cancer is one of the biggest killers of Aboriginal people. And in the adult ward, Background Briefing meets Gay. She's a homeless Indigenous woman diagnosed with tongue cancer. She was sent to Darwin Hospital for chemotherapy, but she was really traumatised by the experience. Dr. Simon Quilty.
Gay's a 50-year-old lady who is originally from Mataranka. She lived a very rough life down there of homelessness and came into hospital late last year with an obvious tongue malignancy, and she was losing weight, and so we sent her up to Darwin for radical chemoradiotherapy, and she ended up having a PEG tube, which is a tube feeding her that goes through her abdominal wall into her stomach, and a tracheostomy to breathe because the swelling around her tongue was so great. And the problem for Gay, she's very miserable in Darwin because she was up on a fourth or fifth floor of RDH and very depressed and saw no future.
When Gay came back from Royal Darwin Hospital, the nurses realised she was deaf, and that's why she hadn't been able to communicate with the doctors and nurses in Darwin. But there, no one realised she was deaf. It was a huge oversight. In Catherine, they got her a hearing aid, and it made a huge difference to Gay's mental health.
She's very hearing impaired. An enormous amount of our Indigenous patients are hearing impaired from severe untreated childhood ear disease. And so often when you're talking to patients, you think that they don't understand, and then you put these headphones on and you realise that they're completely capable of understanding. It's just that they can't hear. And Aboriginal people are very, very polite, and they'll never really try and interrupt you to explain that they can't hear. I'm not sure in Darwin that they recognised her hearing impairment.
So she was just considered as someone who's not communicating?
Yeah. This is very time-consuming to actually sit down and see what she needs. But as you can see by this book, the nurses communicate with her all of the time.
When I visit, Gay smiles and she's happy to talk to me. Well, she can't talk because of the tongue cancer, but she writes her answers in a notebook.
Gay, is this working? Can you hear me? Is that good? So, Gay, can I introduce you? This is Hagar, who works for the ABC. Are you happy to have a chat with her if I put her on here?
Do you want to have a chat?
Yeah. Thanks for talking to me, Gay. Can you hear me? Is that okay? Yeah. How do you feel here at Catherine Hospital? So you're writing down your answers. So you're saying it's good, and I like the doctor and nurse are good. And Gay, can you tell me, how are you feeling up in Darwin? You're saying up in Darwin you were always sad?
And crying a lot. You were crying a lot in Darwin. Yeah. And while Katherine Hospital has made great progress in reducing the number of Indigenous people who leave the hospital against medical advice, in Darwin, the trend is in exactly the opposite direction. Confidential statistics collected by hospital administrations around Australia and obtained by Background Briefing show rates of Indigenous people discharging themselves against medical advice have doubled at Royal Darwin Hospital since 2001. They are seven times higher than for non-Indigenous people. Darwin Hospital now ranks as one of the worst in the nation. In Katherine, the changes have been extraordinary and it's helped address some of the health inequalities. But still, mortality rates are much, much higher in the Indigenous community. Death is something that Dr. Simon Quilty talks about a lot. Out on the veranda, we meet Sarah and her daughter. Sarah is old. She reckons she's about 85, but she doesn't know for sure. She still remembers how, as a little girl, she met white people for the first time.
Can I ask you, how old were you when you first met a white fella?
A long time ago. Yeah, I
mean, were you, when you've been a little girl?
Sarah's daughter, who's here with her throughout the treatment, helps translate the conversation.
When she was 10, eh?
About 10, eh?
We have a bread and a white man.
Never seen white men.
I don't know Kariyarat.
Kariya means white fella.
White fella, Kariya, no, we will learn, but...
Some Kariya used to teach them how to get tea leaf sugar, how to make dampa with the flour.
When elderly people, white or black, come to see me, this lady's very old, and we know that the older you get, the closer you are to the end of your life, yeah?
Yeah.
And so one of the things that I've learnt over the last 5 or 6 years that I've been working with Walpiri people particularly is that elderly people really feel that it's important to pass away on country.
Yeah.
Some of the Indigenous patients here used to call Simon Dr. Death, facetiously, because people were surprised by his direct approach.
I was taught that you shouldn't really talk about these things with Aboriginal people, but I feel that it's really important to listen to elderly people because it's an important thing.
Yeah,
Can you explain why elderly people want to finish on country? From my perspective, I know it's important to be near family when you pass away, but I get the feeling that there's some spiritual stuff,
some
dreaming stuff and maybe some ceremony stuff. Is that right, or do you understand that?
Yeah, I do understand, yeah. Most of the time, like, they really want to be next to the country and where there's kids and you got the own house that you was living in that house before when you was better. You know, and it's sad to lose someone in your arms, you know, but it's also happy because she's died in his own country, in his homeland. Her spirit is still in the house.
Sarah is tired and has fallen asleep in her chair. We leave her to go to the room where they palliate patients who are terminally ill.
When I arrived in Katherine, there was a lot of stigma around death with Aboriginal people that I didn't really understand. And I feel obliged to explain my understanding of somebody's condition openly and honestly. So I often have to tell people that they have a terminal condition. And at first I was told by a lot of people that talking about death was not culturally appropriate. But I don't really agree with that stance because it's a barrier for me to being honest with a patient about their life expectancy. And so I tried as gently as I could to explore that issue, and I found that Aboriginal people are very happy to talk about death and they want to know frankly what's going on, and they want it to be explained in
in layman's terms so that they can plan.
So why were you told that that wasn't culturally appropriate?
I think there's a lot of misunderstandings about Indigenous culture, and I think our Western culture and Australian culture often overlooks the subtleties of it.
Simon is saddened by the memory of getting to know so many young people dying here.
I have moist eyes just thinking about it. The sadness of young death, which I see here all of the time. I palliate people under the age of 40 on a very regular basis, younger than me. It's always very sad to see, and it kind of feeds into the great tragedy and mourning cycle that most Aboriginal people in the Katherine region are almost owned by.
Background Briefing's coordinating producer is Linda McGuinness. The series producer is Vivian Altman. Sound engineer this week is Lila Schunner. Our executive producer is Wendy Carlisle. I'm Hagar Cohen.
That feeling you get when you realize the moon used to be so much closer that it lit up the night sky as bright as an office?
When you realize that there's an object out there that wouldn't just rip you apart, it would erase your very existence?
When you realize there could be alien life swimming in the oceans on a nearby moon?
That feeling you get when you realize that the sun is only 20 galactic years old and will be dead by the time it's 40?
That's what we call cosmic vertigo. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.